Hello, my name is Vanya Chernyul, and you are listening to Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey, Ilya Friedman, how's it going? Looks like you are in a vast warehouse of amazing, amazing film gear.
I am in a vast warehouse of amazing, amazing film gear. So very astute of you. Yes, this is Hot Rod Cameras behind me. And just like a couple of weeks ago, I came in, plunked down at this sort of podcasting cart that we have, and turned on the lights behind me, and voila, here we are. So I was trying to make it easy on myself.
If I had done what you had suggested and I had come to Hot Rod to record with you tonight, which I was just simply too lazy to do, would we have set two cameras up in the warehouse area?
We could, but there's one camera right here, so I figure I'd just probably plop a stool right next to me and we'd do it in a two shot, but whatever. We could do singles that, next time.
That's rather romantic.
the romantic two shot.
Yeah. So Ilya, who is on the show today? I know the answer to this question.
It's a leading question. Of course you do, because you did the interview with returning Vanya Chernyul. Vanya is a friend of the show. I had a great interview with him a few years ago at Camera Image, and you get to chat with him this time about his new show, right?
Yeah. Well, so I get to talk to him about House of the Dragon, where he shot in season two, he shot episodes 6 and 7, 206 and 207, for those wonky enough to want to hear it spoken of in TV lingo, and some really, really good stuff in there. And then also, in addition, he is nominated for an Emmy for Best Cinematography for the Ron Howard documentary.
Oh, yes.
You got it?
Yeah, Idea Man, right?
Yeah, that's right. I was sorry. I was trying to make
I thought I wasn't sure you were trying to push me along.
I was. Yeah, I thought you knew. Anyway,
Idea Man was great, and he did a great job. I really enjoyed that documentary. Yeah. And House of the Dragon, of course, it's very, you know, Game of Thrones, dragon shows and fires and things. And yeah, that's awesome. I don't want to
blow it, but he does talk about how much of the fire was real. And I think we should check into this. I don't know how we find something like this out, because he and I kind of floated this. How would we find out what is the movie or TV show that has the most simultaneous full body burns, where stunt people were lit on fire head to toe? Because they did like 14, and that seems like it might be a record.
That seems like a lot. I think that it would be a question for the stuntman's union. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know if there was ever a movie that had more than 14 people on fire at the same time.
Simultaneously. Yeah, that's huge.
So yeah, that show, they really go for it on that show. And there's if you don't watch House of the Dragon, you could almost skip to the end of 207, and there is like one of the best looking oners I've seen in a long time. And it involves dragons. Oh my God. Nice. So much, such a beautifully choreographed piece of work.
And now, Close Focus.
So for Close Focus today, it's kind of a slow news week in the film world. I mean, like, you know, we were like, do we talk about Deadpool and Wolverine? I mean, what is there to say?
Well, a lot of people went and saw it. They made $205 million, making it the number one R-rated Marvel movie of all time.
Yeah, well, and like at the beginning of this summer, when things like The Fall Guy and If, and there were a few other movies that like radically underperformed, and people were like, theatrical's dead, and movie theater, and I was gloom and doom on here. On the podcast myself, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to watch everything at home by myself like a weirdo for the rest of my life, because no one's going to want to go to the movies. Well, I feel like the summer's kind of turned it around, and we've had several pretty amazing hits. But in the absence of finding like a really clear, like, here's our close focus, we need to talk about, you know, whatever, because obviously there was no news about Rust for us to dig into again. I came across an article on IndieWire called The Best Cinematography of 2024. so far. Because
so know. Far, okay, yeah. Great.
Well, I mean, I will expect that. Like, it's weird to think about this, Ilya, but we're like 2 months away from Oscar season.
I know, it's right around the corner. I mean, it's before you know it, you're going to start seeing those ads.
Yeah, and I just thought it was interesting. And I think, you know, we're about halfway through the year. We're a little more than halfway through the year. And it's maybe interesting to kind of look at the year in cinematography, because I do think it's been a pretty amazing year. It's weird when you think about it. Actually, in speaking to Vanya this morning, because this is one of those few episodes where I interviewed him this morning and the episode goes out tomorrow.
Short turnaround. Yeah.
We have a few others in the can. I don't know, but this one's going right on out. But like, as he reminded me, like, a lot of this stuff was shot during COVID. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, I was going to go through this list that it's a listicle on IndieWire. IndieWire is like one of the places when we can't find a good close focus, when something isn't obvious, I'll usually check out IndieWire, because they've got really excellent journalism. And so I recommend this article, that anyone check it out. It's written by Jim Hemphill and Chris O'Fault.
Hmm. Okay.
Sounds like a pseudonym.
Could be.
Chris.
O'Fault.
I don't know. Ben Rock is calling you out on your weird sounding name, Chris O'Fault.
All right. So they got to include Dune 2 in this list, right?
Oh, yeah. Dune 2 is the one that, like, even they almost, it's the first thing they even kind of mention in here. Dune 2, and I saw the TV glow. And I think that, you know, one thing I've been noticing in cinematography a lot lately is a saturation of blues and purples. Have you been noticing this? I don't know. It's a boring thing to talk about, but like, even looking at the key images here on their first one that they mentioned, Bad Boys Ride or Die, like, you know, it's a very blue purple shot that they got going on there.
It's the A24 effect. There was someone I saw who pointed out that A24 loves to put in these saturated blues and purples. So I don't know. The influence of A24 extending, you know, beyond.
You go A24. You'd think that, I mean, just based on the name, you'd think neon would be more into the saturated colors. But, you know.
You'd think so. Yeah, but you know, not as much.
Basically,
yeah.
The direct competition for A24. So then the next one is, and they name by name, a friend of our show, I believe we've had him on twice, Sayumbu Mukhtipram, who also shot Trap, the new M. Night Shyamalan movie that came out last week, but his movie Challengers. I have seen several online dissections of the work that he did on Challengers. Very impressive stuff. Then Rob Hardy with Civil War. Did you see Civil War?
I have not seen it, but people keep talking about it. And
holy crap.
Prominently used the Ronin 4D. Everyone keeps talking about that.
It used the Ronin 4D, but, and I actually watched a featurette about how they shot it. They used the Ronin 4D for a lot of the in the war stuff, but for a lot of like the calm dramatic scenes, I believe that they shot on the Sony Venice. I want to say someone's going to correct me, but they used like a proper cinema camera. I'm not saying you couldn't shoot proper cinema on the Ronin 4D. It's a great camera. Man, oh man, that movie looks great. That movie is so engrossing. And I kind of went into it a little with some trepidations, even though Alex Garland has kind of never made a bad movie, in my opinion. But that movie, it's just a work of art. It's so well done. It's a movie that I'll be referencing. Nice. Then of course, Dune 2, you know, Greg Fraser. How can you not love Dune Part 2 and Greg Fraser? You know, just Greg Fraser, you know, one of the top people working in the craft today, one of the most influential cinematographers, and you know, him obviously, you know, working with Denis Villeneuve, just visionary stuff. Then the next one on their list, Mad Max Furiosa. Holy crap. I love this movie. I don't like the cinematography as much as I liked the cinematography of Fury Road, but it's still pretty good. Simon Duggan did it, and it looks beautiful.
So do you feel like this IndieWire article is sort of an indicator of where award season is going to go? Do you think you're going to see some of these same projects again for ASC awards, Academy Awards? What's your thinking about this? Are you agreeing with
that? I think Challengers, even though I haven't seen Challengers, I just think the hype around Challengers and how it was shot is going to probably get it some notice. And Mukti Prahm has been doing like world class work for a long time, and it's probably about time he gets noticed. I think Civil War is a movie that hopefully people will remember come Oscar time on a lot of levels. I think Alex Garland could be nominated for it. I think name anyone in the cast, you know, Kirsten Dunst is amazing, but everybody in this cast is amazing. Jesse Plemons has kind of a, I wouldn't call it a cameo, but it's a very small part. He's not in much of the movie and he kind of steals it. It sort of reminds me of Ned Beatty in Network.
He's so great. He's just, he's great in everything. I loved him in Fargo. He's been fantastic. So, all right. Well, we'll definitely have to keep an eye out to see how this race heats up here in the coming weeks, because it's not going to be too long. You're right, before award season is here and there's going to start being campaigns, and you're going to flip open American Cinematographer magazine. And then you're going to see a lot of for-year considerations.
I know.
Those are going to be looking
forward to Long Legs, all the for-year consideration Long Legs. Yeah. There's a bunch of other ones in here, by the way. Kinds of Kindness, shot by Robbie Ryan, Long Legs, which I was talking about. Los Fricas, never heard of it. Looks pretty good. Love Lies Bleeding, definitely a noteworthy film that...
you can watch it on Max right now.
Yeah, Love Lies Bleeding, I need to watch it again. It kind of lost me right at the very end, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I want to see it again. Up until the very end, it was like, wow, this is like Blood Simple, and then it gets... It takes a very bold swing, shall we say.
It gets less simple.
it does something I did not expect it to do. Wow. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. My question is, was somebody written into a corner and couldn't figure out how to write themselves out? Or was this a definite big swing level choice? But Love Lies Bleeding does look amazing, shot by Ben Fortisman. Anyway, I would encourage anyone to check out this article, check out any and all of these movies. Some of them are still in theaters. Some of them are, most of them are streaming. So check it out.
All right. Well, Ben, I think that's a great place for us to leave it. Let's get into the interview with Vanya Chernal.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Thank you very much for coming back. It's your third time on the show, but only the second time that we'll have an actual episode. So, congratulations for all your work on House of the Dragon. I guess my first thought, you know, we've had other cinematographers from House of the Dragon on, but what's interesting to me is like the whole Westeros, the whole Game of Thrones world is so built out and so codified in our heads. What's it like kind of jumping in, because you did season two of House of the Dragon episodes 6 and 7, correct?
Yes.
So what's it like jumping into that, and I guess sort of my follow-up for that is like, where's the creativity, like where do you find creativity in that world when so much of it has been like pre-established?
Well, in a way, because House of the Dragon is such a massive and diverse project, you kind of have to be, it has scenes that are like small dialogue scenes, and then you go to a huge scene with 150 extras and horses, and then you go to a remote location where you can only take a camera and a tripod, you know, with a small skeleton crew. So there's, you know, you really have to exercise every filmmaking or storytelling muscle that you have or you have developed over the years. And no scene is the same and no episode is the same. And also, I think because the visual identity of House of the Dragon, so much of it is in front of the camera, is like the costumes and incredible production. Mm-hmm. Then you can always do little things with camera and lighting to explore and maybe try to do things in a different way as a cinematographer, because what's in front of the camera is so strong and will always glue everything back together into one show. If you have a like contemporary show where camera behavior or lighting is a strong part of the language, here I think what's in front of the camera is so strong that you can do little variations how you shoot it and how you light it. I felt creatively it was very fulfilling for me.
There is kind of a look for Game of Thrones and also for House of the Dragon, but there isn't like one way it's lit or one way it's shot. There are some shows that never go handheld, or there are some shows that would never use a crane or whatever, but I can't think of a piece of film language that they don't use in these shows. They kind of use every tool at their disposal.
Right. And as I said, I think it's because the world is so strong that you can enter it with the fresh eyes.
Yeah. When you think of it, I guess what I am thinking of is kind of just the look, the wardrobe, the costumes, the weapons, that kind of stuff, the acting. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like House of the Dragon uses a larger sensor or something. It feel like, I don't know if I don't know what camera you guys use, but like it feels shallower in depth of field, and it feels like I don't know, you can't say the Game of Thrones wasn't cinematic, but it feels like it's pushing the cinematicness of the look. How do you go about getting that?
Well, we changed things around a little bit in second season. First season was photographed on a large sensor, and it had that beautiful depth of field at a large sensor. As we were getting ready to set up season two, Arri Alexa 35 became available. PJ Dillon, who shot a director of photography, who shot pilot episode, and who was basically setting things up for us, tested Alexa 35, showed us the results, and we all thought that Alexa 35, which has a smaller Super 35 sensor, but because it's such a superior sensor, it would help us in many ways. For example, we on this season we spent much more time on a location, and we thought the superior latitude that this sensor would help us on location on the sets, because most of the sets are built with you have those narrow medieval windows through which if you push the light through the window to light the windows to light those gigantic sets, you would have to fight to preserve the windows because highlights would eventually get blown out with the old sensor. Because Alexa 35 retains the highlights so well, it allowed us to be more source based and really light through the windows, light with practical sources like fire or candle without blowing out the source. So we thought that this would help us, and it would allow us to shoot more film style, and ultimately to have more add more realism to the photography. We worked with fire a lot. And candles,
like blazer. real fire elements. Like there's
real
some
fire. Real
there's,
fire.
Even, there's even some the big fire in those two episodes. There's some big stunts, right?
Right. So it's very helpful when you know that this sensor will retain all the details in such a bright sources, so that you could use that light to light the sets. Basically, that was a big difference in approach, which allowed us to light in a different way. As you know, since we switched to digital, it was all about highlights. It was you always had to protect the highlights, and you were always held hostage by the brightest point in the frame. So whether it's
that's a funny way to put it.
I remember when I shot the Deuce, you had one neon sign in the frame, and now you had to light up the whole set just to match the brightness of that neon sign, so that you could retain the highlights.
It's moving fast too, because like the Deuce wasn't that long ago. It's what was it, like four or five years ago?
This camera, to be honest, it's like, if I always say this, if they called me from Arri and said, what can we do better, I would say I don't know what we can do better. Because they really figured out how to balance the shadows and highlights.
So as I've been watching the show, I've been curious, and I found stuff online that kind of hinted at it, but I wasn't quite sure. Are you guys doing any of the LED volume shooting to like fill out sets or increase the size of sets? My gut says yes, but it's really hard to tell. When it's done right, it's next to impossible to tell.
Because season one was shoot, they still had to deal with the pandemic, and it was limited. They couldn't go to location as much as we could in this season, so they shot much more on volume, with the large LED screens, and then we than we did in season two. The decision was made to reduce the volume work and go out on location more and also build more sets. So the cost that used to go to I think they had the largest volume stage in the world for season one.
Oh, wow.
So we gave that up to be able to spend more time on location and invest more into the sets and other things, which really made me happy because, you know, once I arrived there, I was just blown away by the sets. It's, you know, I remember I was always thinking, you know, when I saw the pictures from, like, you know, Ben-Hur or Cleopatra or something, I was like, I'll never be able to work on sets like this because it's all going to be replaced by virtual cinema and blue screen. But House of the Dragon was different because it was all built, all those incredible sets, not all of them, but, you know, most of them were built. Our backlot was just incredible. You know, the castle with the dock, with the shipyard. There was always almost also a half of one large ship that was built. It's just one of those sets that reminds you of you know, how classical Hollywood was done. So that was very, I really loved it. I really loved it. So I think the LED screens were used mostly for dragon riding scenes. And that was also mostly just to light the actors, not necessarily to do in-camera backgrounds. So we, for example, for the dragon riding scenes, we had, you know, three large LED screens that surrounded, like, it was like 180 or more than 180 that surrounded the actors on this mechanical device called the buck. The LED screens had animated skies in them. But we used it mostly just for lighting. The sky was then replaced, but it was used so the interactive lighting would be as realistic as possible. Interesting thing was that we shot most of the dragon riding in London on the stages in Leavesden before we went on a location. So, at least in my scenes, we shot each scene twice, once for the sunny weather and once for the cloudy weather. Didn't know what we were going to get.
Oh, that's funny.
So the LED screens had, like, one take would be with the bright sun and another take would be with the clouds. And it's amazing how, you know, visual effects, you know, the animation on the screens were based on previous animations that we did. So the sky was completely animated, and it was, I think the lighting in those shots is very realistic. I'm very happy in how the dragon riding looked in 207.
So when you're doing stuff like previs, how do you get involved with that? Does the director bring you in and say, how would you like to set that up? Or are you handed a piece of previs and told, we need to match this look?
No, this was a really great process and because, you know, it was a very well produced project, and we were brought in early enough so that we could go through the whole process, which went like this. It was the first time I did this process in exactly this way. We would start with a shot list, and we would work on a shot list for until we had something we were happy with. We would share the shot list, of course, with the visual effects departments. We would discuss everything with the producers, and then once we were happy with the shot list, we would storyboard. We would work with the storyboard artist to storyboard all the shots, and then we would start getting really into the compositions and the, you know, camera heights. So that was another level of precision. We you know, in order to have the visual effects the best they could be, they needed to know what we're going to do on location as early as possible, because with visual effects, it doesn't really matter how much money you have. Once you run out of time, you know, you can't do justice to the work. So
yeah,
they start to build assets and the dragons and the creatures in the world as early as possible. So,
but you were, like, in that process the whole time.
I was from the beginning, which was wonderful. And right, so then based on the storyboard, the visual effects department would start making previous animations, and this previous animations were really amazing. You know, they were almost like short films. You know, almost like little short films. This is where we really got into the how, you know, what we even committed to certain lengths. Like we wanted to be close with a 32, this distance.
Oh, wow.
Really, really precise. And then we would go back and forth with a previous animation until we were all happy. You know, we had weekly meetings or a couple of times a week where we all sat in a dark room. We watched the previous projected and then we would all discuss it. And then once we were happy with that, of course, at this time, we already saw the location. We've been to the location a couple of times, so we really knew what we wanted to do. And then once we committed to the previous, then on the day when we shot it, we were trying to be as close to what we committed to. You know, of course, it changes a little bit on the day. But we really,
you've thought it out so thoroughly at that point, yeah. You know, you've like lived in that. Well, So I have a kind of a random question about just kind of generally how the show works. So your approach to do House of the Dragon, are you told when they first reach out to you, are you asked to do 206 and 207, or do they reach out to you and say, we'd like to have you on House of the Dragon? Do they show you scripts and ask you which ones you think you would be best for? Do they assess like the work that you've done or, you know, the proclivities you have to figure out which episodes, like, you know, cause you know, I mean, some shows one DP shoots them all, but you know, in the Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon world, it's always been multiple people. I always assumed it was because you have a unit in Morocco and you have a unit in Wales or whatever. But like how is it decided to put you on these two episodes? Because there's like some really specific visuals in these episodes.
It's, you know, it's teams of director, DP, and the first AD. We had five such teams. So I'm attached to the director that directs, and then I prep each episode with the director. Mm-hmm. I got invited to do House of the Dragon by Andriy Perek, who directed episode 206, and he basically brought me on. And then because there were some changes of how many episodes were going to be done, so that the plan changed a little bit. So I was the only DP who worked with two different directors, with Andriy Perek for 206 and the Lonnie Perister for episode 207. So it's really the director. So whatever whichever episode the director is doing.
You're brought on by a director for a specific director. Now you're doing two episodes that are back to back. I have no gauge whether they were shot back to back. I'm assuming based on everything I know about the way these shows are made, you had enough prep for each. It wasn't like, hey, we're shooting 206 and next week we're shooting 207. There had to have been some downtime in between to do all the prep.
Well, yes, it wasn't really a downtime because the prep was as intense as the production period. It was really busy during the prep because we had to do so much. You know, one DP couldn't possibly be able to shoot all these episodes and still give the director enough time to prep with them. So, so that's why we have multiple directors and multiple DPs and multiple first ADs, so we can all prep each episode together while other episodes are being shot. So I was, for these two episodes, I was in London for almost 7 months.
Oh my God, really? Because, for two episodes?
Right, and it's because there was a lot of prep that needed to be done and a lot of location scouting that needed to be done. But it's also, we needed to shoot out locations. So when we would go to Spain or when we would go to Wales, all teams had to shoot out all the scenes on these locations at the same time, basically within a month. We were in Spain for a month and a half. All the directors had to shoot their scenes at the same time while we were in Wales. Then in Spain, then we would move to Wales and then we needed to again shoot all the scenes from all the episodes in Wales. Meanwhile, you know, we would also, somebody had to maybe shoot a couple of scenes on the stage in London because they needed to take down the set and build a new set. So we had two full crews, one that was basically, we called them fire crew and the blood crew. The blood crew was mainly initially the crew that was moving, that was staying on location in the first couple of months on production. And the fire crew was staying in the stages until the very last, until the last 2 months, I think, when we all met in the Warner Brothers Studios in London. And then we were all shooting together. And then maybe, you know, we would be shooting episode 4 on one set while we're shooting episode 3 on the other set. So it was, you know, it all had to happen at the same time. So that's why you have, we had 5 different teams of, you know, just to be able to shoot out the locations and give justice to the prep.
I mean, were multiple episodes shooting at the same time? Like if you're in Spain.
Yes. Not only that, sometimes we would share the same set. So, you know, we would, you know, I would come in with Andre for episode 2 or 6, and we were shooting for 4 hours, and then we would need to hand the set to a next director to shoot their scenes. So the schedule was, there was really no room for error in the schedule.
It, my God, this, I mean, like, I know we're a cinematography podcast. This sounds like a production management nightmare. Like just so many balls in the air that you're juggling when you're making this show.
It was, I must say, when I first saw the schedule, I thought it was the schedule itself was a work of art because it was so many moving pieces and there were really was no room for error.
Yeah.
So you couldn't really reschedule anything because it would be the domino, right? So if you're affected by the weather, that was one of the challenges because you had to always be ready. You know, you had this one day to shoot a scene on the beach in North Wales and you couldn't really move it because it would affect everybody else's schedule. Basically, you had to prep it for a sunny day as well for a cloudy day. You had to be ready for everything when you were on location.
What about like straight up rain though? Like what if you just couldn't do it?
Well, that's an interesting story for episode 207. Opening scene in 207 took place on the beach. It was very important for us how we open episode 207. Lonnie Perister wanted to use the famous duel scene from Once Upon a Time in the West. You know that iconic.
Oh wow! Oh yeah.
Harmonica and Frank, Charles Bronson and Henry Fonda. Just to use it as a reference to, you know, jumpstart the process. We knew exactly how we wanted to shoot it, but then we also wanted to have a right light for every shot. So we made a plan of which shot is going to be shot in the morning and which shot is going to be shot in the afternoon, so we would get the right light for every shot. Then we learned, because on the beach, that the tides are really violent on the beach, so we had to now apply this schedule to what the tides were doing.
Oh my God.
For every shot, we had to jump to a different part of the beach because
oh
the tides.
Oh my God.
So it was, I wish we did like a little time lapse so you could see that the crew like moving around the beach.
That's, tide. Is bonkers.
But then 3 days before we were supposed to start, you know, before we were supposed to shoot it, we learned that it was going to rain on the day, and of course we couldn't move the, we had to shoot it on that day, and we decided to embrace the weather, and it really worked for us. I think the scene is better because we decided to push through and shoot it into the rain. I think we had the stormy clouds and the actors were, you know, wet from the rain. I think it really added production value. So, you know, you just had to, even on a massive project like this, where you want to have as much control as possible, you have to embrace to whatever is happening on location, which is, that's why I love this. You know, sometimes we wanted to shoot on a, you know, in a remote location and we could only go there with a very small crew, you know, like 16 people or something like that, which is like size of a student.
Oh my God.
And hand carry, you know, tripod and just a couple of pieces of equipment to a remote location. And the greatest thing is like sometimes you get most epic shots just because you brought the camera to the right location with just a few people. So it was really a lot of fun.
You make it sound fun. I think that's, you know, it's something that I feel like we get like all caught up in the hard work and the gristle of this sometimes, but it actually does sound fun to be like hiking up a mountain with a bunch of gear and just getting a shot no one else could ever get.
Well, as I said, and it's because every day was completely different, you know? Mm. So that's, I love television like that when it's not, you know, when it's like a movie, really, you have to approach like a film.
We have to talk about a couple of things in there's a little bit of it in 206, but 207 you've got some dragon burning up people stuff followed by what appears to me to be an outrageously epic one-er where we're following a character as dragon mayhem is happening in the background, in the foreground, all over the place. You know, like to me, like these are the moments when I think about like what I love about this world is not just the presence of the dragon, but it's like the staging of sequences like this that feel so freaking cinematic, that like feel like, you know, Children of Men level one-ers, and just like so expertly executed. Can you talk a little bit about that stuff and how you went about, if there was a previs or a storyboard, or how do you do that? Because, you know, I know it's television, so the schedule's probably a little shorter than if you were out making a movie, you know, and God knows you might have had to give that set to somebody else in 3 hours. How do you execute that so well?
Well, it's basically, the key is in pre-production, and we did go through the process that I described earlier. For every scene that had dragons in it, or some complex stunt work, and in that scene we had to be as precise as possible. First, because of all the visual effects work that was supposed to happen, but also because, you know, those people on fire, that's all practical. That's all our stunt team. So there was
insane.
It's
not a trivial amount of people on fire in the scene. There's a lot of people on fire.
Well, I think in one shot, we had 16 stunt people being blasted by the flamethrower and, you know, that caught on fire.
I wonder like what the world record of the most people in one shot in a body burn must be.
I don't know. I think this is pretty close to it. And it's... Yeah. It's really, when you're there in person, watch this happen, it's really mind-blowing because, you know, even though I knew these are some of the best stunt people in the world and they really know what they're doing, they've done it before, still, when you watch it happen, it's like, it's like people, you know, people on fire. And we had in one shot, people on fire falling from the ceiling. So it was just incredible to watch. But once they catch fire, they could only be lit up for some like 8 seconds. I'm not sure how long, but it was something in that range. And then, you know, people come with fire extinguisher and take the fire out. So yeah. that was another reason why we had to be as precise as possible how we wanted to shoot it, because you don't want to keep doing it. You want to do it in the least amount of takes, of course, as possible. You know, they were happy to do it again, but you don't want to, for obvious reasons.
I mean, seriously, because people make mistakes, and if you just keep doing it over and over again, eventually.
Yeah, and it's not, they make it look easy, but I'm sure it's not easy to do it.
Is it a real one-er, or are there hidden cuts
There are hidden cuts.
Good.
I even forgot where the cuts were, but, you know, we were...
It's convincing as a one-er.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad. We were really, really, really happy when we saw the fight. It's also great with the action of the dragon, because, you know, these monsters look the best when you don't see them very well. You know, when they're lit by fires and they, you know, come from shadows. And I think the dragons look really, really good in that scene.
Was there any practical dragon, or was that all VFX?
Because it's supposed to be this gigantic cave where this huge creatures live, and of course that was it was not possible to build such a massive set, so only the plinth piece was built, which was very high, almost to the set, to the ceiling of the stage, and everything else was like a sea of blue screen. So while we were doing it, one challenge was just to maintain the sense of scale, to know where you are in the space and where the dragons are and what the dragons are doing. Because if you're in an ocean of blue screen, you try to imagine this big creature turning around. So now you're like, okay, how fast did it happen? Where's the tail of the dragon? Yeah. You know, so it was really an exercise in inner visualization. We had help from the visual effects department. They provided us with iPads that were loaded with a Cyclops app, which was showing us. It was almost like a viewfinder where you could see what the virtual world is.
Oh, nice!
Interacting with what's practically in front of the camera. So that was a great help. Another great help they also provided was they had one large blue head of a dragon that two puppeteers were operating all the time. So that was something that gave us an idea.
I was wondering, because there's that, you know, like we get some pretty close contact between person and dragon there in that sequence. And I was like, and it looked very convincing. I was like, I wonder if they made, like, if they went all Jurassic Park and made a full dragon head.
Yeah, it was one head with the two, you know, blue people operating it. So it was.
Was it a blue dragon head, and they replaced
blue dragon head with the two puppeteers dressed in blue like outfit completely.
So is that mostly for scale, or I guess they could track the motion of it and put the motion into the real dragon?
I think it was.
The real
thing. It was also marking for them where the dragon is supposed to be and how the actors are reacting to it. Also for actors to know where the creature is at the moment. It was just one thing that was just orientation for all of us. But still, that was just a head. And Lonnie used this audio system that we always have on the set. It's called the Voice of God. It's like a, you know, if you see the pictures of the directors directing through a megaphone or something, we don't use megaphones anymore so much. It's we always have this basically large speaker with a microphone available. So Lonnie used this system, Voice of God, to describe in real time as we were shooting, to describe what's happening so that the actors could hear what's supposed to be happening in front of them. But he would, you know, go as far as he would start breathing like a dragon. He would come closer to the actor. He would start breathing heavier, and he basically performed the dragon. It was amazing to watch. And I think that's why it helped actors tremendously, of course, but it helped everybody else to understand what's going on.
That's amazing. That's just, yeah. it's so amazing to hear, you know, I mean, you know, it's such a complicated thing to jump into like that. I also would be deeply remiss to not talk to you about Emmy nominated Idea Man, the Jim Henson documentary you shot for Ron Howard. We've had Ron on the show before. Kind of tell me about how that project came to you, because like, you know, in true Ron Howard fashion, it's a perfect workmanlike documentary that tells the story, and you know, like you will watch this documentary, but also there's like an emotional component to it in the way that like some of the they're not reenactments, but the way pieces of it are filmed, like it uses so many different techniques. So if you could, you know, like tell me about sort of the genesis of that stuff.
Well, one of the process was, you know, Ron filmed all the interviews first, and then the film was evolving from the, you know, what came out of the interviews with all these different collaborators and family members of Jim Henson.
Did you do the interviews at all?
I did mostly the interviews, and it was, my very good friend Igor Martinovic, who's an amazing DP. He shot the first interview, and the challenge was, because you know, there was this set that was basically the box. Jim Henson really was the master of the medium, so we wanted to always always have that relationship, what the actual medium that he was expressing himself in was. So that the idea of the box came from that, and also the stop motion photography with
I love that stuff.
You know, the producers were not sure when the next interview would happen because it was all the availability of the interviewees, and you know, they were shot in different parts of the country, and we had to make sure that either we never knew whether I'll be shooting the interview or Igor will be shooting the interview, because you know, some interviews were not scheduled too far in advance. So the idea is that we wanted to be able to recreate this set and exactly the same lighting setup wherever the interview is going to happen, whether it's in Los Angeles or somewhere else in the country or in New York. In the first couple of interviews, we recorded exactly, you know, how far the camera was from the interviewee, what the depth of field was, how far the lighting was. We had this floor plans where everything was marked so that if it had to be recreated somewhere else, and if somebody else had to shoot it, which didn't happen very much, but we had to be ready for that also, that they had a plan that they could reestablish the whole set, rebuild the whole thing, and rebuild the lighting. So that was early on in the process, you know, was figuring out how we were going to keep recreating this, however many times necessary.
How many times did you end up having to recreate it, and how many different people ended up having to do that?
I think, well, it was me and Igor most of the time, and I think one other person shot. Yeah, that was the idea, that, you know, that to come up with a plan that then can be executed whenever and wherever. I prepped a film, a live-action film, Sesame Street, for Warner Brothers. This was, I think, 2018. The film, unfortunately, never
I was about to say, I have a six-year-old son, so, like, I would definitely know if there's a Sesame Street movie.
Yeah, and I hope it still happens. But
is the IP not big enough?
It was tried a couple of times, and I hope it'll still happen. But I was in preparation for that film. I read a lot about Jim Henson, which I was very interested in that, because it's also from, you know, it's probably one of the first, I think Muppet Show was one of the first thing that I remember watching on TV with my family. So it was a very.
Which one?
The Muppet Show. It was a very, you know, it was something that I was very, very intimately interested in. So I read about Jim Henson and that his biography. But then in preparation for the film, I had the privilege of going to the Sesame Street set to talk to the performers and the puppeteers. We had to learn how each puppet moves. You know, sometimes, you know, there are two people operating. Some characters are operated by just one person, and we had to learn how the Muppets move, in order so we could plan and shot list of how we were going to shoot it. So it's like every shot was a technical challenge. For example, if you need, you know, a couple of these characters to go through the door, now there are all these puppeteers. They also have to go below the frame. Yeah. Through the door. I knew practically how it worked. And then listening to all the interviewees who were there as Jim Henson was creating this world was just a unique privilege.
I know, that's just got to be mind blowing. Cause, like, you know, Jim Henson's kind of an experimental filmmaker who went extremely mainstream. Like, what he did was all kind of, if like, the Muppets feel like they're woven into the fabric of our culture. So I can't imagine a world without them, but it's, you know, puppets weren't big business before Jim Henson.
Right. Right. When we were prepping that project, I remember we had a scene that was supposed to take place in Times Square. So we were talking with the police about how we were going to control the crowds and, you know, which parts of the Times Square we could shoot at one time. You know, we could control this if you had Tom Cruise walking on the Times Square. But with Big Bird, I don't know how we're going to control it.
I would just imagine in Times Square, there's somebody walking around as a Muppet all the time. I mean, it's probably more like an Elmo than a Big Bird. Big Bird's a complicated suit. I actually saw the documentary about the guy who played Big Bird. And, you know, I never realized that, like, he only had one moving arm because his other arm was operating the head. And so when you watch Big Bird, usually one arm isn't moving, and that's because that's like this guy.
It's incredible. And then having them, you know, interact with the real world and real locations, that's which is also something that Jim Henson pioneered.
like in the original Muppet movie, that first song, Rainbow Connection, like he's sitting on a log in a swamp. And right. I guess Jim Henson was basically buried in the swamp operating Kermit the Frog. Right. Just crazy. So were you involved in any of the stop motion-y kind of stuff as well?
Yes. Yeah. We for every interview, we shot some of that. And it was we did it both ways. We did a real stop motion, and mm-hmm. then we did the same movement with a continuous 24 frames, so that they would have flexibility in the post. But most of the stop motion was real, actually stop motion.
And had you ever done stop motion before that?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I feel like it's like a super specialized thing to do, but it looks like, from the outside, having never done stop motion, it looks like so much fun to do it, though. Like just a very creative thing.
Well, then you're also doing it with people who also are not, they just came to an interview and now they have to, stop motion animation. So that was fun. There were a lot of, we also shot that during the pandemic. So, the first interview I shot, Ron got COVID that morning. So we had to quickly figure out, because he, for that interview, he couldn't be there in person. So we had to quickly, improvise how to do the interview remotely. We built, this, whatever equipment we had, we put the monitor as close to the lens and put it together quickly. We did it like this on Zoom. But it was something that had to come together like really quickly. We didn't plan for it. So.
Ah, poor guy. Oh, man.
He still did an amazing interview. So.
No, he's a rock star. He's one of the best to ever do it. He's so great. Well, cool. Well, congratulations on all of this. And thank you for coming back onto the show. Before we go, obviously, we'd like to encourage anyone who has Max or HBO, check out House of the Dragon season 2. Watch the whole season. But, for the purposes of this episode, episodes 206 and 207. And also, if you have Disney Plus, check out Idea Man. What else do you have coming up? Do you have anything fun coming up that you want to plug?
Nothing I can really talk about yet, but
it's always the case.
As you know, it's a strange time in the industry. Hopefully, the production will start in the fall, as usual. So, but
the mantra is alive until 25. Like everyone's just like, let's ride this mess out. So besides that, do you have a website or anything where people can check out your work?
Yes, thank you. It's www.vanyacernyul.com. So it's www.vanyacernyul, like my name.com.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show again. It was great to have you, and congrats on all the stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So that was our interview with Vanya Chernyul. Vanya, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It was great having you once again.
And now, Short Ends.
So Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It is when we talk about our pet obsessions. It's about, it could be anything. What are you all about this week? What is your pet obsession?
It's a kind of a news story that's kind of a bummer, and it's not super surprising, but David Lynch, who I believe is 72 years old, came public with the fact that he suffers from emphysema after a lifetime of smoking. And like, to picture David Lynch is to picture him with a cigarette in his hand. And he basically said that he can't go to film sets anymore. He can't. He actually said he's not planning on quitting directing, but he can't like physically go to a film set. And, to a degree, you could have him there on, ostensibly a Zoom, watching the monitor from his house. I feel like definitely would miss out on something a lot. No surprise that a lifetime of heavy smoking would cause health effects. And David Lynch is, definitely a one of a kind director. I have loved some of his films. I have been less in love with some of his films, but they're always interesting, except Inland Empire. I didn't care for that one at all, but except for Inland Empire, I think all his films are at least, pretty interesting. And Inland Empire has its moments. I think it's, I don't think there's a cure for emphysema, so maybe this is, sort of a chronic condition he's going to suffer with for the rest of his life. But it does bum me out that we won't be getting, you know, another David Lynch movie. We've gotten a lot out of him. So, you know, including like, you know, I wasn't the world's greatest fan of the third season of Twin Peaks that he did for Showtime a few years back. But there were definitely, for me, moments of transcendent genius in it. It just, in my opinion, was overlong. But it's just a humongous bummer to me. And, you know, he's worked with some amazing DPs, Freddie Francis, Peter Deming. You know, he definitely has like left a mark. And I'm interested to see if he starts directing stuff from home somehow via Zoom. And yeah. does that create either a great precedent where, you know, directors
roll out of bed and start directing?
Yeah. Where maybe directors who had some kind of a physical impairment that prevented them from running around the set could go make, you know, their Fitzcarraldo follow-up. They could do that. Or, you know, if it then becomes like, I'm always afraid about remote technology, about controlling a film set, because it's going to eventually bleed down to greedy producers. Like schlocky bad producers who are going to be like, we don't need to have all those people on set. We don't need to feed them lunch. And, you know, everything will just be done remotely by robots. And, you know, that's not a future I want to live in.
Yeah. Thankfully it's a not in your lifetime kind of thing.
I hope not. Anyway, so Ilya, what's your deal this week?
Well, a lot of people don't know, but a lot of people do know that Fujifilm makes a camera called the X106. It just rolls off the tongue. It is the most in-demand camera right now, possibly one of the most in-demand cameras of all time. Why? Just as the X105 was one of the most in-demand cameras of all time. And it's because a series of people, and look, I want to be diplomatic here, but I'm going to say amateur photography equipment reviewers on YouTube and various forms of TikTok and social media started saying how amazing this camera is. And it is a good camera. And this goes for the last version, the version 5 too, was a good camera. But enough people went out there and said it's the best thing since sliced bread that Fuji has not been able to fulfill the backlog. And don't get me wrong, the X105 was totally fine when it came out. But 2 or 3 years after it came out, it became even bigger and huger during the pandemic. A lot of people decided they wanted to own a camera, and it wasn't traditional.
I mean, you got to film your sourdough starter. I mean, and it's like, you got to film yourself doing Wordle and then sourdough starter.
Look, it's a step up from any phone, period. It is. Is it as good as other higher end cameras? Absolutely not. But it kind of fits in this place that a lot of people, a lot of like pundits in the camera space were saying cameras were dead. They said that, oh, this sort of like, you know, hybrid bridge sort of in between sort of like point and shoot style camera. Nobody wants that anymore. That's basically what people are saying. And it's true. A lot of those really, really fell off, but this is a camera with a fixed lens, and it's got some cool, you know, functions inside of it. But here's the thing. There's an article on F-stoppers, and it's from April, but I completely slept on this. I did not know at all that this article had come out, but they interviewed the marketing director over at Fuji, who then explained that they're 500,000 units backordered, and they are producing 15,000 a month. If it's true, we're not getting really enough units then. It doesn't seem like a company is making 15,000 a month. Maybe they are, but we haven't been getting it. We get them trickling in twos, threes at a time, a certain amount every month. And our backorder people are really, really thrilled to have them. And I'm glad that, you know, look, we've had to do zero advertising for the X106. Whoever has been promoting them on YouTube and retweeting and reposting and redoing whatever has built the community of potential camera buyers into such a fervor that they decide they must have it. They're selling on eBay for $1,000 over cost. I am convinced that some of the people on our pre-order list, they're just flipping them, trying to make a quick grand.
And oh, that's a good idea.
You know, I'm gonna
have to go over to Amazon while you're talking.
Good luck, because it's going to take months. And here's the thing too, let's just take Fuji at their word for these numbers. 500,000 back order, 15,000 a month. That means
another 3 years to fulfill the current back orders. They're going to come out with another camera. There's going to be the X100-7 before those back orders are fulfilled. Now, Fuji could increase production, but if demand suddenly drops off and then they're stuck with all these cameras, that could be a failure. So they have to play it as well as they can possibly play it, keep people, you know, wanting this camera, but hopefully they don't get, you know, tired and move on. I got to say, there's a bunch of other great alternatives that are available now, including other ones made by Fuji, which I would say arguably better cameras. So
if you could get the camera, how much does it retail for?
$1,700. I think so, right about $1,700.
Yeah. Really? Okay. Cause I feel like there's like, what's your,
maybe it's a little bit less, maybe it's 1500, but it's like, it's in that
sort of range. When you get to that level, there's a lot of excellent cameras in that budget range.
There is, and you could go a little bit more, you could go a little bit less, but enough people have just decided that's all they want. That's what it is. So it's very interesting. Good problem for Fuji to have, still a problem. And Lord knows every single camera shop, us included, like we look at the traffic of what people are searching on our website, and it's almost always, usually it's like Arri, usually it's like Sony Venice, usually it's like Burano, it's usually like some big cinema cameras on our website. The last like 4 or 5 months in particular, it's been Fujifilm X100-6, which, you know,
your mission is to make the next meme stock camera something that you have plentifully in stock.
But nobody has that. So, but yes, you're right. I need to turn something we have in stock into the next meme camera.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. You need to start hyping a camera. And, you know, like, I would believe you if you told me. I have believed you on so much gear in my life. Like, most of the gear I have is stuff that I, like, ran by you first or got knowing you would make fun of me for getting it and didn't want to tell you about it. But I feel like, you know, if you said that it was, you know, whatever, the Sonys that we're using to film our the host wraps on here, you know, like, that's a pretty solid camera. It's in that general price range, right? It's a little less, isn't it?
It's a little more, actually. It's $2,200. So technically, it's a little bit more, about $500 more. So.
But it's like the same friggin' sensor as the...
As the A7S III, which, you know, look, for someone who, like, in the photography space, there are all of these sort of price segments. It's in one of the most segmented markets out there. It's like cars. You know, if there's a $15,000 car, an $18,000 car, a $20,000 car, all these different price segments, it's even more so in cameras. And cameras, you know, the price segments are $100. It's really interesting. The way
and I go back to what Fraser Bradshaw said about we're living in the era of peak sensor, you know, that, like, basically if you're good at what you do, you can get something good out of most of the sensors. Like, you know, obviously a Sony Venice or something is going to do a lot better than a mirrorless DSLR camera. But yeah, you know, I mean, to use the example of Civil War, which we were talking about earlier, you know, so much of that movie was shot on the DJI 4K camera or 4D camera, excuse me. And you know,
sub $10,000 camera.
You're not going to look at any piece of that and go like, oh, that looks, this part obviously looks like crap. The whole movie looks great.
It has everything to do with the person using that camera and much less to do with that camera.
1,000,000,000%. Yeah. That is the answer.
All right. Well, you can make the same argument about musicians. Like, you know, it's like guitars don't just suddenly sound great on their own. It requires someone who knows how to play it. Yeah,
it's true.
All right. So Ben, I think that's going to about do it for this week here. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
Track me down at benrock.com, just the way it sounds. You know, check out my reel, check out my stuff. Hopefully I'll have some new stuff to add shortly. I'm crossing my fingers. You can find all my social media and all that stuff there. I'm still on Twitter, still on Instagram, not especially on TikTok. I mean, I have a TikTok account, haven't once posted a video. I'm sure the day is coming. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Find me over at Hot Rod Cameras here in Burbank or in Portland, Oregon. So yeah, reach out and hit me up here. Ben, who do we have to thank this week? Who made this show possible?
Well, I definitely want to thank Alana Cody. I want to give her an extra special, super extra thanks because we had to roll with some punches on the Vanya interview. partly because I had a technical issue, and then we had, and then Vanya was nice enough to postpone the interview, and Alana handled all the scheduling, and then his trip from Europe to New York, where I think he's at now, got postponed or something, and Alana handled it all with aplomb. So thank you, Alana, Cody, for everything you do. Don't ever think that we don't appreciate you. We should also thank Michael Dispenza, our intrepid, relatively still new editor. Hope he's not pulling his hair out and screaming and running down the street and saying, why did I agree to this just yet?
So far, I don't think so. I think he's doing okay.
Yeah, no, he's doing a great job. I just hope we're not driving him insane. And then last but never least, we got to thank Kazal Trakshi, who composed every scrap of music that you heard on here. Check out his website, musicbykaz.com. And, you know, you can hire him to compose your next score or do visual effects on your next film or color grade it or direct it. He does all those things.
I think you nailed it. So, Ben, do you want to take us out?
Not especially. No, you can do it this time.
Until next time, it's the Cinematography Podcast.
All right. Cool.
How about that? Does that kind of work?
Sure. Yeah, it's good. It's good.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.